absolutely see the implications of the doctrine of redemption for social change. Now, Christian churches have, of course, all often tended to talk about redemption individualistically, thereby avoiding its social implications. But precisely the fact, you see, that it is the church that preaches this doctrine. It is a doctrine about the church, that is to say, about man redeemed in community. This makes it evident that you can't even here avoid the social dimension of the doctrine of redemption, because it's not just incidental to it, it's not just an extension of it, but it is basic to it, that you are redeemed in community and so on. Now, today I'm going to kind of look through certain classical patterns of the doctrine of redemption. It's a very rich and complex doctrine, and therefore it can be and has been interpreted in several different ways. And these different ways of interpreting make very different pictures of the relationship between history and society to the kingdom of God, to redemption, and so on. I think as we go through some of these patterns, you can see why certain tensions within the doctrine of redemption tend to obscure or dim its social implications, and hence why social reform today often appears in secular form. Now, in this sketch of basic patterns of the doctrine of redemption, I've laid out somewhat sassily three different types. These aren't, of course, mutually exclusive, because they tend to sort of run into each other at the edges, you might say, but I think there are somewhat distinct central thrusts, although they are constantly kind of running into each other at the edges. The first pattern, what I call the pattern of apocalyptic crisis, is the earliest view of redemption in Christianity. It is the view in and through which the gospel was born. Now, apocalypticism itself grew out of Jewish prophetic futurism, in the period roughly 200 BC to 130 AD, the period of the beginnings of the apocalyptic writings to the Zionist uprising of Simon Bar Kokhba, the final exile of the Jewish people. This was the apocalyptic period in Jewish history. Now, the prophetic tradition, the earlier tradition of the Old Testament, out of which apocalyptic grew, operated within the two poles of the Abrahamic faith, the poles of covenant and promise. God had made a covenant with his people that he would be their God and they would be his people. And God's covenant implied a promise of fulfillment as a people. The covenanted people would be a mighty nation. They would inherit a land flowing in milk and honey. They would possess the land in peace, in virtue, and in prosperity. And these are expressions of an expectation of fulfillment as a people through faithfulness to God, the faithfulness of God to his people, the response of the people in obedience and fidelity. Now, in the light of the covenant and the promise, catastrophes to the people were interpreted as infidelity of the people to God, and God's wrath upon his people in turn. And so there enters the prophetic concept of judgment. The prophet appears as the one who pronounces judgment upon the people. He interprets the signs of the times in terms of God's the people's infidelity and God's wrath. But God's wrath on the people is never absolute. And this is why, you see, we are wrong when we judge Jews from outside. It never implies that God has broken his covenant with his people. Rather, God's anger always implies that God is determined that his people should be his people, In other words, the work of judgment itself functioned within the twin poles of covenant and promise. Through God's wrath pronounced his judgment for the prophet, God seeks to convert the people, to bring them back to fidelity to him. And when that happens, then, of course, the promise will be fulfilled. Finally, when the people are faithful, then the promise will be fulfilled, and all the images of godliness, happiness, prosperity, fruitfulness, peace in the land can be evoked as symbols of the expected fulfillment. So these were the structures of thought which provided a key for the Old Testament to interpret history, the history of the people in relationship to God. Now, this expected fulfillment, as you can see, is not an otherworldly salvation. It is a future world, a future worldly era, which stands as an ideal and a goal of the community. However, as the Jewish people suffered repeated exiles and hardships, the overlordship of conquering people, the expectation of fulfillment continually postponed and mocked by the tides of events, the concept of fulfillment itself began to take on an increasingly radical and apocalyptic tone. The promised fulfillment ceases to be seen as happening in continuity with present world history. There is to be a radical break, a cosmic intervention of God, an overthrow of the evil powers. In other words, the view of the expected good age becomes radicalized. And in turn, the view of man's present dilemma and his adversaries also is radicalized. The adversaries now are seen no longer simply as defeats within the people and national enemies outside, but these come to be seen as agents for some cosmic evil power. Furthermore, this cosmic evil power is seen as having captured this world. You see, so this world is no longer God's world. It has been taken over by the evil powers. It has become the kingdom of the evil one. So the cosmos is now seen as being ruled by alien and hostile forces contrary to God. Therefore, it's no longer possible to think of redemption within this present cosmos or historical framework. This world or this present epoch has been taken over. It's ruled by evil, you see. So much so that its basic and ruling principle has become diabolic. Therefore, salvation can come only by a radical breakthrough from without, an overthrow of this present world, and the inauguration of a radically new world and epoch founded on an entirely different principle. The principle of God's rule, God's kingdom, rather than the kingdom of the prince of this world. So there has to be a great cosmic showdown between God and the powers and the principalities of this world, an overthrow and judgment once and for all, and a creation of a wholly new world in which God's justice and righteousness will be vindicated and prevail. Now, the point to see here is, first of all, a kind of foreshortening of history. You no longer think of some kind of movement, but you stand, as it were, in the crisis point. History is foreshortened. There's no idea of some powers already at work in the system that can carry you over. There's no concept of progress, really, here. I think that's the important thing to see. In a real apocalyptic point of view, there's no concept of progress because there's no imminent good within the present system that already exists. You stand in the crisis point between evil and good and a confrontation between the two. Now, there may be a period of trials, to be sure, the birth pangs of the Messiah may be a period of trials. But this is never seen as lasting a long time, certainly not 2,000 years. It's always brief and decisive, and you stand at the crisis point between the diabolic powers and the rule of God, which is about to come, always imminent, about to come, break in and overthrow the present evil powers and inaugurate the good age. Now, the apocalyptic view of redemption is, well, it's social, for one thing. It is basically social, and it's sort of outward directed. You see, in other words, you don't look inward to some salvation of your personal essence within yourself. You look outward at history, at the empires, at society, at injustice, oppression, cruel and unjust destruction, and so on. It is this outward social, political, historical realm that is to be grappled with. This is what has to be radically reversed. The apocalyptic view, of course, is also born of social extremity and despair. One despairs of progress and change within the present system. In other words, the present system is totally corrupt. There can be no salvation within it. Salvation can only come from without, when the present system, the present era, the present world, etc., is radically overthrown. And a new era founded on an entirely different principle is brought in. So apocalypticism is the religion of oppressed people. Not, of course, oppressed into unconsciousness, but oppressed people who are conscious, who have woken up to their oppression, but who see no hope of altering their situation within the present system, within the present, whatever you want to call it, the world, the system, the present cosmos. They're all sort of interrelated. That's why the New Left and the Black Power people talk about the system, you see. It's the same idea as this world, really. Now, because of its intrinsic radicalism and uncompromising confrontation with the present system, apocalypticism is sort of the implicit or explicit underpinnings of every revolutionary faith. Every movement which believes that the present system cannot be reformed, that it is totally corrupt and irreformable, that it is quite literally diabolic, that the only solution is radical overthrow and reconstitution of the world on a radically new and different basis, such thinking is apocalyptic. Now, the second view, taking a phrase from contemporary society, I've called tune in and drop out. Now, the second view, like the apocalyptic view, also sees the world as being in the grip of evil and demonic powers. This fallen or anti-divine world, however, it tends to associate with human, social, and political structures, also, of course, as the apocalyptic does. The outward structures of society, and even, of course, the outward structures of physical existence, so your body and so on, the outward structures of the physical world, the outward structures of the political, the economic world, and so on, these are viewed as bad. Salvation as coming by some outward overthrow and reconstitution of the political system, in other words, some historical drama. Salvation is seen by a journey inward to some pure realm beyond the system. In other words, salvation here is seen as a metaphysical drama rather than a historical drama. Salvation is an inward transcending of the present world rather than a historical transcending of the present temporal epoch. So this second view is antisocial, tends to be more individualistic, and anti-historical. Now, the important thing to see here is that the transcendent realm is beyond the system. It's transcendent to it. It's other than it. But it sort of coexists in time. In other words, it's already present. The Pure Land coexists in time, or at least it's available now. That's the important thing. It's available now. It coexists in time with the fallen realm. In other words, you don't have to wait for it to come. It's already here. It's available. It's available here and now, but you have to move out to find it. It is above or outside, or however you want to call it. These, of course, as we learned last hour, are mythological phrases. It's above or outside the present system. Now, this means that when you move out to the Pure Land, you leave the false fallen world behind, basically unaltered by your inward journey. In other words, you move out to the Pure Land, but the evil fallen world persists. It persists basically unaltered by this inward journey. You see, where the apocalyptic view presupposes that this fallen realm is really going to be grappled with and changed. But the inward journeys to a Pure Land, which is presently available, but it leaves the present system unaltered by this inward journey. One simply removes oneself from this evil world and finds the Pure Land through some kind of mystical transcendent experience. Now, characteristic of this inward journey, we might say, characteristic of this inward journey is some sort of physical removal of the seeker from the present system. This is sort of a way of expressing it, you might say. In other words, the evil worldly system is associated with, say, politics or economics or somehow the flesh and so on. And so one reacts by removing oneself from these structures. You get out of the system. You withdraw from involvement in the forum and the marketplace. And if you read the Fathers of the Church, it's interesting to see that the forum is much more an evil symbol quite often than the flesh, particularly the Eastern Fathers. It's the forum, the marketplace, and the political scene, which is really the symbol. You just can't be saved there at all. You see, so you remove yourself from the forum and the marketplace. Quite often this involves sort of physically removing yourself from the city. That's what we're doing here. You remove yourself from the city as the center of worldly activity, and you flee to the country as the symbol of unspoiled nature. Now, such a view carries, I suppose, in part a romantic view, an assumption that civilization is bad, but nature is good. Nature being symbolized both by the uncivilized physical nature, all these mountains and lakes and so on, but by implication, this physical nature, unspoiled physical nature, by implication, this symbolizes also one's own original human nature. One's own original good human nature, which can be recovered by removing yourself from the city. So the whole impulse to retreat to the countryside tends to convey this suggestion that one's true human nature is not so much destroyed as simply overlaid and stifled by the false bondage of society. And so one flees from the city to unspoiled nature. And when you do that, then your true human nature will reemerge again. Now, poverty, of course, is also another typical theme indigenous to this view. The economic system stands for a fallen worldliness. It stands for a dispersion and loss of soul amid all kinds of false concerns and busyness and so on. You lose your soul as you pursue all of these concerns. So you have to drop out of the economic system. You give up property. You give up economic security. You simplify your personal needs down to a very elementary level. Quite often this means you live as a kind of a bum. See, you become a bum, you just beg for a living, or you go out and live off the nuts in the woods, or maybe if a little bit more practical, you kind of go back to subsistence farming. You go back to subsistence farming. No more trading, just produce what you need, kind of thing. Go back to a primitive economic level. Now, freeing oneself of economic wants and duties, you achieve freedom, inward peace, and joy. I think perhaps the most developed expression of this view is probably the Franciscan mendicant. Franciscan mendicant with only one tunic and stole, only one tunic and cloak, rather, which served as his garment by day and his bed by night. You know, kind of walking along the dusty roads, whistling as he went, no place that he came from, no place that he's going, you know, just traveling, begging for what he needs, and serving whoever he meets, serving God's poor, wherever he meets them. This is, kind of a classical example of salvation by economic dropout. Now, the symbol of going unto the poor is kind of interesting, because out of this you get a whole motif of serving the poor, charity, and so on, which would seem to imply social reform. However, in this view, this serving the poor has always been prevented from becoming any concept of real social reform, because the original purpose of it was not to serve the world, but to withdraw from the world. In other words, it was formed out of a world-negating ethic. You see, in other words, you don't go unto the poor in order to change the social conditions which make them poor. You see, you go unto the poor because they are a symbol of rejection by the system. They have been rejected by the system. They're not in. You go to the lepers. They symbolize most perfectly people who are completely left out of the system. So you go unto them as a way of identifying with the outcast, and this is also a part of the world-negating ethic. And this prevents, you see, your service from really becoming a way of changing the conditions which made them lepers and poor people and so on, because that's really because of the world-negating ethic out of which this movement arises in the first place. Now, nature, we talked about going to nature, unspoiled nature. This is a kind of ambivalent symbol in Christianity. Nature is a symbol of the pure, good world, as God originally created it on the first week, I guess. But it's also a symbol of the demonic world as well. Nature is both the trackless wasteland of desolation and the garden of paradise. This is very nice. In that first book on your list, I recommended William's book on this, which is, I think, a beautiful expression of this whole ambivalence toward nature. In the Desert Fathers, who were the originators of the monastic tradition, uncultivated nature was seen as the realm of the demons. You go out to the desert because that's where the demons live. In other words, the hermit drops out of society because it's the snare of the devil, but he goes out into the wilderness not only to flee from evil society, but also to confront the demons in a pure and naked state. He can really see them out there. So the inward battle against the evil forces which constrict the soul is sort of projected, you might say, into a dramatic conflict between the hermit and the demons in the desert caves and wastelands. Or he goes into the tombs and fights the demons. And so if you ever read the life of St. Anthony, he's like battling with, he's out there fighting with the demons. Now, the hermit, you see, by this battle, he conquers the demons. But the hermit, by long prayer, fasting, and self-abnegation, gradually conquers the demons and overcomes their influence. And in doing this, in conquering the demons, he converts the desert into a paradise. In other words, he redeems the desert and brings it back again, not into the world, but brings it back again into the original garden. And so we have the themes, you see, of the hermit who is fed by manna in the desert. That's M-A-N-N-A. He's fed by manna in the desert. Springs of water spring up, you see, as he touches it with his staff. Springs of water spring up in the desert. The dragons and the lions come around, and they kind of fawn at his feet, and they bring him figs and so on. So all of these are symbols of the redemption of the desert and the bringing it back into the original paradise. Now, in the monastic tradition, I think this was expressed very concretely, you might say in a less fanciful way, as the cultivation of the desert. In other words, the monastic, during the Middle Ages, the monastic renewals were constantly sort of moving out of the old structures. The monastic renewal was constantly moving out of the old civilization into the forests and into the trackless wastes. But out there in the forests and the trackless wastes, they were constantly creating little paradises. You see, they were constantly planting a colony and a model community on the uncultivated land. So in effect, they became the pioneers without meaning to do this, you see. Under their labor, the uncultivated land became a fruitful farm, resplendent with fields and orchards. And so the impulse to redeem the wilderness gives birth to the utopian movement. I mean, I think the utopian movement really comes out of this same impulse. In other words, you move out of the fallen or evil society, but you form in the wilderness a utopian community. Now, this, of course, often ends up willy-nilly in just becoming incorporating the wilderness into the economic system. And that's why they had to keep moving on to new trackless wastes, you know, because this bloody monastery got to be so rich, you see, and so it sort of fell back into the economic system. But of course, you didn't originally do that in order to bring it into the system, but originally the idea was to create a higher society, to create a paradisal nature, not with the idea of just bringing it back into civilization, which one has left behind, but of creating the new society, the new paradise. So here is a concept of redemption of nature and also redemption of community as well. In other words, you try to form a new community and a new society, a whole new, out in the desert, you recreate the paradise. You try to create a new nature and a new community, which will live in the kind of harmony, love between man and his fellow man, love between man and God, that God intended. Live in the kind of harmony with nature, with one's fellow man, and of course all of this surrounded with God, the kind of harmony that God intended. This is the principle of the new community. So the movement to form a utopian society is, you might say, the positive side of the movement to tune in to the inward truth and drop out of the present evil world. So you can see that the impulse to tune in and drop out can be very fruitful. It can give birth to a number of world-redeeming results: service to the poor, reclamation of the wasteland nature, creating a new utopian community. But it does all this within a basic movement to negate society. To negate society and nature as it is. Now, this world-negating ethic means that it seldom moves in sort of directly against the evils of the world with a desire to redeem them. In other words, there's no impulse to universal salvation. It does not move to redeem present society, but it removes from present society and creates a elite utopian society within which salvation can be glimpsed. But present society is left behind to fester to itself. And so while it releases sort of ideal movements, idealizing movements, it does so always within a kind of small framework. It releases no impulse to attack directly the problems of the world as such. Its primary impulse is toward inward freedom, through dropping out of bondage to the present system, and at most it creates a little sphere of provisional society outside of the present system, in which for a moment a kind of provisional utopia, for a minute you can kind of glimpse how it ought to be. But it has no message of salvation for the city of man, which it has deserted. Finally, we have this third view. As I said, they run into each other a little bit. This third view, which I call the Great Master Plan. Now here again, this is sort of related to, well, they're all sort of interrelated, but here again, salvation again is viewed historically as a historical drama. But not as the historical drama of sharp conflict and reversal, but rather as a process, a long development from an original good state towards some kind of early reversal way back there, but nevertheless good powers working, then new redemption coming in, and finally you evolve up to the final completion. Salvation runs through history as a process which defines its development from beginning to end. The adversaries of good and evil are sort of projected back to the beginning. There's a sort of an original conflict of good and evil at the very beginning, and then these powers work themselves out through history. History is viewed then as a redemptive program from this fallen state forward to a redeemed state, and this redeemed state is then seen as somehow elevated to a higher level. In other words, it's not just circular, but there's the paradise at the beginning, but then somehow the final completion is on a higher level from the original paradise. There's always a kind of tension between these two. Now, classical Christian theology seemed to me have always sort of assumed this historical drama in one way or another. Whereas Christian spirituality, classical Christian spirituality, has tended to operate more in the ascetic world-denying type of view. There's been a kind of tension between the two. If you read Aquinas, you'll see that his cosmology is all this great master plan, you see, whereas which presupposes that the body is good and so forth, and it's all working itself out. Whereas when you get to his ethics, suddenly you get the world negating. So there's kind of a tension between classical Christian spirituality and classical Christian theology. Theologies have tended to operate with this great master plan point of view. Now, in some of the early church fathers, the concept of salvation as history was universalistic. It really saw the whole universe as participating in some great process, and therefore also cosmological. It was a great historical cosmological kind of story. As I said, there's a sort of tension between a circular tendency and a developmental tendency. In Origen, for example, you have more of a circular pattern. Origen believes that all reality ultimately will be saved. Even the devil, the last enemy, death, will ultimately be saved. So it's complete cosmological salvation, it's universal salvation. But there's a kind of circularity which, in Origen's view, he sees salvation as a cosmological drama, which moves from a spiritual state of the original creation, which was purely spiritual, then a fall into matter, and the creation of the material world as a part of the fall, and then a gradual evolution back upward to the spiritual realm through a long evolutionary drama. Now, there is a certain concept of development here, because there is a concept of moral development. The last state is morally better than the first, because it has become something which you have chosen in freedom. Basically, in terms of, you might say, the ontological structure, it's a sort of a circular drama. The goal is to return to the origin. With Irenaeus, also late second century father, the developmental axis is more pronounced. Irenaeus has a theme of the recapitulation of the beginning. To be sure, there's a sort of theme of the paradise recapitulating the beginning. But this recovery takes place through a sort of upward spiral through history, so that the last state of the universe is indeed better than the first. It's, you might say that what was simply implicit in the original paradise is now fully revealed. Sort of development of doctrine idea. Fully revealed in the last state, and there's also the theme of it being sort of spiritual, eternal, in a way in which the original wasn't. But as you can see, there's a tendency toward a sort of total cosmological view. Now, with Augustine and the Western Orthodox tradition generally, these more cosmological emphases tend to be subordinated, it seems to me, to the drama of sin and election. The two cities, the city of God and the city of the devil, are elected from the beginning. The city of God hidden like a mysterious leaven within history. But the development is one of sharp conflict of principles of being, sharp conflict between two principles of existence. And so there can be no final synthesis between the two. There can be no salvation of the eternal, earthly city. Rather, the drama of history is a gradual growth of the city of the elect, which grows in sanctification as we move from Israel to the church, and then the final completion. But the final completion is a separation out of the heavenly city from the worldly city, its elevation to its eternal reward, and the corresponding discarding of the earthly city into damnation. Now, this concept in practice, it seems to me, tended to sort of constrict the original sort of universalistic concept of salvation. First of all, it tended to bind salvation within the sphere of the historical church, because the historical church was seen as the last epoch of salvation. Now, we are already in the last age. We're not expecting the last age. We're already in it, and it is the church. This is the sixth era. So salvation was bound within the sphere of the historical church as the last epoch of salvation, and therefore it was forbidden either to relativize this era, you know, the historical church itself might become passé. You couldn't relativize this era itself, nor could you really venture beyond its boundaries to discover elements of salvation beyond it, either in the non-elect or however that might be interpreted, the reprobate outside, whether these be Muslims or Jews or whether this be somehow the sinners. And so you tend to get a kind of complacent ethic which redeems its own community, the little Calvinistic neat city of the elect, but you don't go unto the sinners outside. And this, of course, carries over into a lot of our attitudes. I mean, you know, suburbia and the slums and all that. Now, even in Augustine's time, there was a tendency to challenge, you might say, the monopolizing of salvation by the historical church. challenging the finality of revelation through Christ, perhaps, at least as this had become monopolized by the historical church, and a sort of reawakening to a sort of larger view of this historical drama. As I said, even in Augustine's own day, the Montanists, Donatists, and so on, you could find this view. But the development of the doctrine of the Third Age, the doctrine of the Third Age, is particularly associated with the medieval mystic Joachim of Florus. He was the one who mediated this view, although you can find it as far back as the Montanists. This concept of the Third Age, he mediated it to the late medieval radicals and so on, who constantly operated on this theme. In fact, I would say radicalism all the way down through all of the utopian movements has always sort of appropriated this concept of the Third Age. Now, according to this view, both revelation through the Father and revelation through the Son are seen as provisional revelations. But soon to come is the final and decisive revelation through the Spirit. The age of the Spirit, which is soon to come, which will usher in the final redeemed state of the universe. Now you can see when you say this, suddenly you restore a kind of sense of historical expectation. Salvation just isn't monopolized by the historical church and then all you expect is sort of heaven after death. But suddenly, historical expectation is restored. You have a new era ahead of you. You restore the sense of historical expectation, which was lost in the Augustinian dualism of salvation, and its appropriation of the means of salvation exclusively into the historical church as it is. You restore a sense of dynamic, which hopes for something that can still surpass what presently exists within history, and you look for a visible manifestation of salvation within history itself. Now, there's some great powers and a kingdom will really be revealed visibly in history ahead. Now, this concept of a third age seems to me went on down through the utopians and then kind of emerged again in a secular form in the liberal doctrine of progress, the concept of evolutionary development of mankind that emerged in the 18th century and became almost the social dogma of the 19th century. The evolutionary doctrine, the doctrine of evolution of mankind, concept of progress. In this liberal view, or the doctrine of progress, the kingdom of God becomes totally secular, that is to say, historical. It is this worldly rather than otherworldly, and it is brought in by the immanent forces within history rather than through divine grace. Now, this is always a tricky thing because this problem of immanence, because you could say, we don't have within our human nature immanent powers as we are. But then you say, but from our original created nature, which is a grace, we have these powers. So you can read out a kind of grace through creation. Or you can say, through our fallen state, we don't have these powers. But Christ has come, and therefore we have within the church or within history already operating some powers of grace. In other words, there are various ways within, you might say, good theology of interpreting grace as working as fruits within history, and therefore of having grace, not something you're just waiting for, but something already at work, which, if it doesn't reproduce, at least comes very close to an imminent view of the workings of salvation in history. Now, the social gospelers, the Christian socialists and so forth, tried to reconcile this whole problem. They tried to reconcile the whole doctrine of grace
with an incarnation and so on. They tried to use these themes of creation, incarnation, to sort of convert, you might say, the pure immanence of liberalism to a more theological view. But the secular concept of progress, in effect, really didn't buy that, because it really had, in effect, cut off the transcendent poles, of a kingdom beyond the world and the transcendent pole of a God beyond the world. In the secular liberal doctrine of progress, these transcendent poles are, for all practical purposes, eliminated, and history, nature itself, is seen as developing through its own immanent powers to some final perfection. Now, these are very, very sketchy ways of trying to sort of survey background for the material we'll be talking about. And what I'll be mainly talking about is the way in which these different models of redemption reemerge in modern times in kind of secular form, or at least a form that doesn't presuppose the way in which Christians are used to setting this drama up. And quite often in doing this, they bring out very surprising aspects that were really there in interesting ways or in the early tradition, but had been sort of glossed over or quite deliberately repressed by the church appropriation of this tradition. So they bring out very surprising and authentic aspects of the doctrine of redemption, but in a way that prophesies against the church tradition. The church theologians, in turn, the sort of liberals, you might say, or the avant-garde or something, are constantly trying to reinterpret the current doctrines, the current secular doctrines of salvation, back into theological terms. So they're trying to bring it back into the tradition and reveal it as being founded on this more transcendent concept of a source and goal. They're constantly trying to reinterpret it back into theology with various compromises, because they want to sort of get with the new salvation that's going on. The secular people, however, I think quite characteristically, are very little impressed by the efforts of the church theologians. You know, for some reason, the new left couldn't care less about Altizer and so on. They're very kind of not impressed by the efforts of the church theologians to reinterpret the secular doctrine of salvation into theological terms, because they regard this whole church tradition as a part of the evil system, see, which is going to be, you're already a part of the reprobate, and you can't save yourself by trying to get onto our bandwagon. You belong to the reprobate, and the church and all its works and pomps is consigned to the kingdom of the reprobate, which is about to be overthrown by the new apocalypse. So the church finds itself in the kind of embarrassing position of being the old Egypt, from which all the new Israelites are all fleeing, carrying away, of course, with them all of the church's spoils, all of the church's goods. So there is a high tension between these Christian theological models and the secular models of salvation, but there's also, of course, a tremendous amount of interchange, both because these are the spoils of the church which people have stolen, and because the church reformers are constantly trying to get on the new bandwagon in some way or another. There's both a high tension and an interchange between the theological tradition of world salvation and these various models of secular salvation, which we'll be talking about, which have arisen out of the dissolution of the theological tradition in modern times. I don't know what time it is. We've got a little time. Do we have, why don't we have a little, got some questions? on this. This is one of those kind of awful introductory survey things where you try to lay out some general ideas. But you've got some questions on the
has there been, when you say that our age today has to be compared a lot to the
well, I think you get all three of the models, and that's what I'm going to try to show. I mean, this is taken, as you can see, straight from one model, and it's very current today.
In our prison data, if you were to compare this with the population, importantly, how can you see this?
You mean that this is a moment like this kind of moment?
How do you compare it, yeah.
Well, I think historically there are interesting similarities. Well, I mean, the ancient world, as it moved out of its classical formulations, came into period very much like a modern period, in which it felt its old gods were dying and so on like that. And so that strikes very familiar chords. I mean, some of this sounds familiar when we read Euripides and so on. He's a modern man, you see. But various answers emerged to this question. When you felt a sense of crisis, as you do in any time of reform, you feel a sense of crisis, dissolution, and so on. But then there are various ways of trying to get at it, and all of these ways emerged in ancient times as a way of trying to get at what this meant. And I think they are all very much current today. And you still have this is the liberal concept of progress is in a certain sense almost the old orthodoxy, but it's still very much with us. It's still the way in which every liberal will ever go. I was talking about church form, you know, the new sort of theological radicals, and he said, well, I don't believe in overthrowing the old, I believe in sort of tacking onto the old and adding new rooms and so on like that. You know, and I said, well, that's kind of interesting. He said, I don't believe in parallel structures. You see, making some new structure and leaving the old. I said, well, I didn't say it, but if Luther hadn't been willing to create a parallel structure, something new might not have entered history. In other words, sort of adding onto the old isn't always enough. So you have to risk this terrible thing of creating something which will be in conflict. So on like that. So these are always psychological ways of getting at it. There's always the one who wants to say, but we have to, you know, there's no way of just reversing like this. We have to build on. And I think most of us are really liberals at heart. And then there is always the kind of radical who believes that salvation is available by moving out into some contemplative world. And then there's the other kind of radical who moves out in another way by, you know, burn baby burn kind of thing. The quietist and the activist radical. And certainly these are all here today.
In the apocalyptic model, isn't there a kind of tuning into the inward truth much the same as in the second man?
Well, there's a tuning in, but you can't sort of it's not it's sort of not quite there the same way sort of by going into your soul or going upward in mystical contemplation. In other words, it's a sort of a different, it's sort of a temporal model where the evil world and the new world confront each other sort of sequentially rather than hierarchically. So the mystic sort of leaves and goes up, you know, the ladder of contemplation, and then the radical kind of tunes in by leaping over in anticipation of a new age. He can only tune into it by anticipation, you see, because it's not there until it comes. It's a historical coming. It has to break in and so on. That's a you know, very different kind of mood.
Like illustrated by the debate now on the draft version.
have that apocalyptic carried through. We're going to carry this right straight through. There's no hope for any kind of change. Go to jail, get back, burning cars, and so on. You know, to have a consistent approach right through would be pretty much number one.
Well, you see, I think the new left and the hippies and so on are really, they use an apocalyptic kind of thing, activist kind of thing, and yet I would see them really more this way because they really don't have hope. They really don't have hope. The apocalyptic can sort of pronounce a sweeping judgment on the present thing because he really believes the new age is imminent, out to come. And he has this tremendous hope, whereas, in a certain sense, the tune-out guy has no hope. He doesn't really think anything can happen to the system, and so he finds a kind of pure land someplace else that he can draw to. And I think, as a matter of fact, there was an article in Bias, to a young intellectual of the New Left in Commonwealth, was entitled this. It was called "Look, Mom, No Hope," and it was this kind of resistance, but without any expectation.
Isn't it true that the radical and also the violent movements within our society are not really apocalyptic in a sense that the justice or the new breaks in? It is really founded on own strength. It is a social reform movement that is based on human strength, the group that is severing itself, whereas the apocalyptic was expecting that the new will break in by God's action.
Yeah, there's a breaking in from the outside. This is the whole movement, which goes right through Marxism and so on, of imminent forces working to produce a new age. But as I said, this gets very confused by the Christian doctrines of both creation and incarnation, which assumes that grace is, yes, our powers are weak, but grace is somehow not just to come, but already. There's an already as well as a not yet. So you have to say, well, not just I, but God works within me. And as soon as you say that, you have this other kind of concept. So the liberal doctrine of progress, as you take the social gospelers and so on, always try to interpret it. Not us, but God already at work in history and so on like that. But sometimes it's very hard to distinguish between us and God, as we know. And it, of course, there's nothing more dangerous than when you say, not I, but God wields this sword, which kills you, you see. And that's, in a certain sense, what the apocalyptic says. You see, this present age is given over to the devil, but the crisis is already beginning, and I have become the instrument to tread the grapes of wrath and so on like that. And that's what the apocalyptic radical does.